Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of reading selections about the black community. This week, I'll be reading from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the British Broadcasting Corporation History Magazine, the Associated Press, the Baltimore Afro-American, the website wordinblack.com, and I'm starting with the story titled, Hair Extensions May Contain Chemicals Linked to Cancer and Reproductive Issues. This was written by Audie Conan and published February 11, 2026, in the magazine Scientific American. Dozens of hair extensions, including artificial and natural braids, may contain synthetic chemicals that are a health and environmental hazard, a new study shows. At least 12 of the 169 chemicals detected in the new analysis have been associated with cancer, birth defects, and reproductive issues and are included in California's Proposition 65 Hazardous Chemicals list. The study, published February 11th in Environment and Health, tested 43 hair extensions, including those made with synthetic hair, as well as untreated raw human hair and other bio-based hairs such as those made from banana-based fibers. All but two of the products contained a hazardous chemical, and nearly 10% of them had organotin compounds, synthetic chemicals linked to endocrine-disrupting effects. Some had concentrations above the European Union limits. More research is needed, however, for government agencies to determine whether the chemical levels found in these products requires greater regulation, the study authors say. The hazardous chemicals we identified each carry their own risks, said Elisa Franklin, lead author of the new paper and a research scientist at the nonprofit research organization Silent Spring Institute. Our findings showed that these products can expose people to multiple chemicals over time, and through repeated use, these combined exposures add up. More than 70% of black women in the United States use hair extensions at least once per year, including hairstyles such as braiding, a staple of many black cultures that's been shaped by the slave trade, colonialism, and Western beauty standards. Chemical relaxers, another product commonly used to style black hair, that permanently straighten curly or kinky hair, have previously been linked to higher risk of uterine cancer. On one hand, I'm excited to get the work out and share this new knowledge with the world, Franklin says. On the other hand, I'm learning this new information leans toward the idea that my community is deeply polluted with harmful chemicals, even down to practices that are so embedded in the culture, like getting braids. Using a chemical library, Franklin's team winnowed more than 900 chemical signatures picked up from the hair extensions down to dozens of potentially harmful compounds. In samples of synthetic hair, they found levels of chlorine as high as 277,000 micrograms per gram. The Centers of Disease Control and Prevention reports that exposure to chlorine, a flame retardant at 60 micrograms per gram for 60 minutes or more through inhalation, can lead to lung irritation and impaired function. The researchers also flagged some samples with small traces of fluorine, a chemical that can lead to lower birth rates in high doses, as well as organohalogens and nitroaromatics, both known to have carcinogenic effects. The study didn't determine whether any particular amount of chemical exposure from the hair extensions was above legal standards or would necessarily cause health issues in people, however. The limitation makes it difficult to create safety guidance, Franklin says. But the work aligns with a growing trend. A 2022 study found traces of potentially harmful heavy metals in synthetic hair, and a 2025 analysis in Consumer Reports found that hair extensions used when braiding contained volatile organic chemicals, which can irritate the eyes, nose, and throat, as well as cause potential long-term kidney and liver damage. In the new study, the detection of more different classes of potentially harmful chemical contaminants is evidence that these products contain more chemical types than our findings showed, says James Rogers, Director of Product and Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports, who led the 2025 analysis. He was not involved in the new paper. Bio-based hair products, such as those made from silk or banana-based fibers, are generally better options than other extensions. But the study found that some bio-based extensions, labeled as non-toxic, contained unclassified complex chemicals. Although those chemicals might not be dangerous, Franklin advises caution. Bio-based doesn't automatically mean safer. That was the Scientific American magazine article titled, "Hair Extensions May Contain Chemicals Linked to Cancer and Reproductive Issues." It was written by Audie Conan and published February 11, 2026. My next reading is titled, "Another Win for Lax Heirs in Fight Over Her Cells." This was written by Joseph Williams and published March 12, 2026, at the website wordinblack.com. For decades, the story of Henrietta Lax has carried a painful contradiction. The cells taken from her body helped transform modern medicine. Yet the black woman behind them died poor and unknown, buried in an unmarked grave. Now, more than 70 years later, her estate has reached a settlement with pharmaceutical giant Novartis, ending a lawsuit that accused the company of profiting from a racist medical system that exploited black patients like Lax, L-A-C-K-S. It's the second settlement in a series of legal battles brought by the Lax family, which argues that biotechnology and pharmaceutical firms built fortunes from Lax cells while her descendants struggled with chronic illness and limited access to health care. Terms of the agreement, announced Monday, March 9th, were not publicly disclosed. But the case underscores a larger reckoning in American medicine, the long history of research practices that use black bodies without consent, and the question of who benefits from the scientific breakthroughs that followed. Dr. Uche Blackstock, a physician and advocate for health equity, says the exploitation of blacks was so insidious that she, a black woman steeped in the issues of health inequity in the United States, used those cells during her medical training at Harvard Medical School without knowing they came from Henrietta Lax or that her cells were taken without consent. The settlement with Novartis is a step toward accountability and a reminder that medical progress should not be built on exploitation, says Blackstock, an emergency department doctor, author and founder of Advancing Health Equity, a strategic consulting firm. Lax was just 31 when she died of cervical cancer in 1951. A tobacco farmer from Southern Virginia, she had moved with her husband to Turner Station, a historically black community outside Baltimore, where the couple was raising five children. When she noticed a knot in her abdomen, Lax sought treatment at Johns Hopkins Hospital, at the time the only hospital in the region that treated black patients. Doctors there discovered a malignant tumor in her cervix. During a biopsy, physicians removed a sample of her cancer cells. Like countless other patients of the era, Lax was never told the tissue would be used for research. What happened next would change the course of medical science. Unlike most human cells, which die quickly outside the body, Lax cells survived and multiplied in laboratory dishes. Scientists soon realized they could reproduce them indefinitely, making them the first human cell line capable of continuous growth. Known as HeLa cells, H-E-L-A, derived from the first letters of her name, the cells became one of the most important tools in biomedical research. They helped scientists unlock discoveries about cancer biology and genetic mapping. They were instrumental in developing the polio vaccine. Researchers used them to study HIV, Ebola, and tuberculosis, and they even traveled aboard early space missions. Most recently, HeLa cells were used in research that contributed to the development of COVID-19 vaccines. The scale of their impact is staggering. By 2011, researchers estimated that more than 50 million metric tons of HeLa cells had been produced and used over 60,000 scientific studies worldwide. Yet for decades, the Lacks family knew nothing about the role Henrietta cells played in science, or the profits generated by companies producing and distributing them. That story became widely known after journalist Rebecca Skloot, S-K-L-O-O-T, published The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks in 2010, a best-selling book that explored both the science behind HeLa cells and the family's struggle to understand how Henrietta's tissue had reshaped medicine. Oprah Winfrey later portrayed Henrietta's daughter, Deborah Lacks, in an HBO adaptation of the book. The lawsuits filed by the Lacks estate argue that companies using HeLa cells benefited from a medical system that, during the Jim Crow era, routinely treated black patients' bodies as resources to be exploited without consent or compensation. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who represents the family, said the settlements represent at least a measure of long overdue accountability. For the family and her grandchildren, this is certainly justice because people said they would never realize any benefit or compensation from her immortal HeLa cells, even though these pharmaceutical companies were profiting billions and billions of dollars, Crump told the New York Times. But he added, no settlement can undo what happened. If it was truly justice, none of this would have happened to Henrietta Lacks, Crump said. She wouldn't have been the victim of medical racism at Johns Hopkins. But you can pray to get some measure of justice, to offer respect and dignity to the life that was taken. For the Lacks family, and for many advocates in black communities, the settlements represent something beyond a financial agreement. They are another step in an ongoing effort to confront the legacy of medical racism and ensure that the people whose bodies advance science are treated with dignity, consent, and fairness. More than 7 decades after her death, Henrietta Lacks cells are still alive in laboratories around the world, and her story continues to reshape the ethics of medicine. That was the article titled, Another Win for Lacks Heirs and Fight Over Her Cells. This was written by Joseph Williams and published March 12, 2026, at the website wordinblack.com. My next reading is titled, Only 5% of U.S. Doctors Are Black. Howard University alumni are working to change that. This article was written by Megan Sales and published in the Baltimore Afro-Americans Afro.com website on November 13, 2025. If you're black and looking for a doctor, it might be hard to find one who looks like you. The Association of American Medical Colleges, AAMC, estimates that just 5.2% of physicians are black, despite African Americans comprising nearly 14% of the U.S. population. The Howard University Medical Alumni has stepped up to address this gap through Need More Black Doctors, a campaign designed to strengthen the pipeline of black physicians by tackling the systemic barriers they face. Systemic racism is real. The historical exclusion from medicine, lack of access to medical training, lack of finance, lack of exposure at all ages to science education, resources, mentors, and role models, and financial indebtedness, said Dr. Annette Bay Shaw, president of the Howard University Medical Alumni Association's Board of Directors and 1984 graduate. Even once a decision is made to pursue a medical degree, the road to success is often uncharted for black Americans. The AAMC reports that while black applicants for medical school increased by 2.8% in 2024, there was a 11.6% decrease in the number of black students who actually enrolled compared to 2023. This was the third consecutive year of declines, according to the AAMC. The Howard University Medical Alumni Association is hoping to stop this trend. Through Need More Black Doctors, the organization provides scholarship opportunities to aspiring physicians and deploys emergency grants to medical students experiencing financial hardships. It also hosts educational workshops, networking events, and leadership training to prepare students for their future medical careers. The organization's larger objective is to expand awareness, both in the medical community and broader society, about the importance of representation in healthcare, including its impact on patient outcomes. In a 2023 study published in JAMA Network Open, researchers found that U.S. counties with higher representation of black primary care doctors had longer life expectancy and lower mortality rates among black patients. Dr. Earl Thurman, a 1987 graduate of Howard University College of Medicine, said this is in part due to a greater level of trust. Trust is the cornerstone of the physician-patient relationship, and there's more trust based on what people see, what people hear, and what people understand about the culture of individuals, said Thurman. He emphasized that black doctors are also more likely to practice in underserved communities which face greater health disparities. Data shows that when you have more African-American physicians, they tend to practice in areas where African-American people are, said Thurman. That brings health care closer to the population that's in need. At present, the Howard University Medical Alumni Association is working to expand the reach of the Need More Black Doctors campaign and to attract more donations to support scholarships and grants for students. For students who are considering pursuing a medical career, Thurman encouraged them to remain persistent and resilient in spite of the challenges. More importantly, think of the impact you'll have on the greater community in pushing yourself to greater heights. It's a wonderful career, said Thurman. We need more African-American young people to go into healthcare. It's a public need. That was the article titled, Only 5% of U.S. Doctors Are Black. Howard University alumni are working to change that. It was written by Megan Sales and published November 13, 2025, in the Baltimore Afro-American Newspaper's Afro.com website. My next reading is titled, From Slavery to the White House, the Ficklin Family Served Presidents for Nearly 8 Decades. This was written by Darlene Superville and published March 15, 2026 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. John Rory Ficklin, F-I-C-K-L-I-N, was 7 when he learned that his father, the son of a slave, was important. It was 1963, and the nation was mourning President John F. Kennedy. Rory Ficklin was sitting with his mother and brother, watching funeral coverage on TV in the family's Washington apartment when she gasped. His father, John Whitson Ficklin, was wearing a mourning suit and standing beside Kennedy's casket with other White House ushers. He was a White House butler at the time, but Kennedy's widow, Jacqueline, asked that he join the ushers that day. Whitson Ficklin worked a remarkable 44 years on the White House residence staff. His son, Rory Ficklin, had a lengthy White House career too, 40 years on the staff of the National Security Council. Presidents come and go from the White House every 4 years or 8 years, but the Ficklin family, Whitson Ficklin, his wife, some of his brothers and sisters, and son Rory Ficklin, was a constant presence there for nearly 8 decades, serving 13 presidents from Franklin D. Roosevelt to Barack Obama. One family by the president's side for one-third of America's 250-year existence. With his 2015 retirement, Rory became the last Ficklin employed there full-time, capping a record of family service documented in his book, An Unusual Path, 3 Generations from Slavery to the White House. The book is my family's history, it's African-American history, and it's our country's history, he told the Associated Press in an interview. My dad and I both stand on my grandfather's shoulders, and I like to think that we both contributed a lot to our country. The first chapter in what Rory Ficklin described as a truly American story opens with his grandfather, James Strother Ficklin, who was born a slave around 1854 in Rappahannock County, Virginia. Strother was a water boy for the Confederate Army during the Civil War. After emancipation, he did odd jobs for the family that used to own him. He remarried in 1894 after his first wife died during childbirth and moved to Youngstown, Ohio to escape racism in Virginia and earn a living in the booming coal and steel industries. Records show that they returned to Rappahannock some years later, though it is unclear why. Strother and his second wife, Helen, had saved enough money to buy 37 acres of land in Amosville, Virginia in 1901. He built a house and farmed the land to help feed the family. After Helen died while giving birth, Strother married his third wife, Valley Lee Davenport, in 1907. They had 10 children, 5 girls and 5 boys. One of those boys was John Whitson Ficklin. Whitson Ficklin was 15 when he moved to Washington in 1934 to live with an older sister and her husband. He worked odd jobs and went to high school at night, graduating in 1939. The year an older brother, Charles, began work as a White House butler. Charles Ficklin helped him land a part-time position washing dishes and doing whatever the butlers did not have time to do themselves. Military service during World War II briefly interrupted their White House careers, but they received promotions after they came home, with Charles Ficklin and Whitson Ficklin becoming head butler and butler respectively. Whitson Ficklin met President Harry Truman and First Lady Bess Truman on his second day as a butler when he served the couple breakfast. New promotions followed under Dwight Eisenhower, with Charles Ficklin becoming maitre d', the most senior butler, and Whitson Ficklin taking over as head butler, putting him in charge of 6 full-time butlers. Whitson Ficklin succeeded his brother again in March 1967 when Charles Ficklin retired. Whitson Ficklin was now responsible for the planning and execution of White House social events, ranging from luncheons and state dinners to birthday parties and South Lawn barbecues. There were visits by British royals and the annual round of Christmas parties, the White House wedding of Richard Nixon's daughter Tricia in 1971, and Gerald Ford's daughter Susan's decision to host her senior class prom at the White House. Along the way, Whitson Ficklin earned the trust and confidence of the presidents and first ladies who relied on his expertise. Some sent thank you notes after flawlessly executed events. First Lady Patricia Nixon wrote in October 1969 about the great number of complimentary remarks we received following each White House social event, according to a copy of the letter reprinted in the book. Our family is most grateful to you for the time and interest you devote to make each occasion so enjoyable and memorable for our guests and for us. President Jimmy Carter expressed appreciation in a March 1979 letter for the work Whitson Ficklin and his team did surrounding the signing of an Egypt-Israel peace treaty. Everything was perfect and we are grateful, Carter wrote. Whitson Ficklin retired in May 1983. In perhaps the biggest show of appreciation for his 44-year career, the Reagans invited him and his wife Nancy to a state dinner that year for the Emir of Bahrain. He is believed to be the first member of the White House resident staff to be a guest at a state dinner, and he became the subject of a media blitz as a result. Whitson Ficklin sat at the First Lady's table and told an interviewer that she put me at ease and made me feel like a guest. Asked about the service, he replied, "Those are my boys. I trained them." Whitson Ficklin died in December 1984 at 65. Seeing my dad on television was a big deal. To see him participating in our president's funeral service was beyond my youthful comprehension, Rory Ficklin wrote. He said years passed before he understood the severity and the importance of his father's work. Yet Rory Ficklin ended up doing important work at the White House too. After a summer job during high school delivering sealed envelopes between the White House and the special prosecutor on the Watergate investigation, he also worked for his father in the pantry during state dinners and other big events. Rory Ficklin joined the NSC staff in 1975, beginning a 40-year tenure that overlapped with his father and other family members. He started by working evenings as a clerk while attending college during the day, and by 1987, he was training new staff. Under Obama, Rory Ficklin was promoted to Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. He retired in 2015 with a special request for his boss, National Security Advisor Susan Rice. Could he attend a state dinner like his dad? Rory Ficklin and his wife, Patrice, were invited to the 2015 state dinner for Chinese President Xi Jinping. With some minor alterations, he wore the tuxedo jacket and cummerbund his father wore in 1983. The dinner was the highlight of his career, he said. Just to experience firsthand the quality of the service, the precision of the butlers, the type of service that they provided was a legacy to my dad, actually, Rory Ficklin said in the interview. That was the Associated Press story titled, From Slavery to the White House, the Ficklin family served presidents for nearly 8 decades. This was written by Darlene Superville and published March 15, 2026. Next, an obituary. Rod Page, nation's first African American to serve as Secretary of Education, dies at 92. This was written by Sophia Riddle and published December 9, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. Rod Page, an educator, coach, and administrator who rolled out the nation's landmark No Child Left Behind law as the first African American to serve as U.S. Education Secretary, died Tuesday, December 9th. Former President George W. Bush, who tapped Page for the nation's top federal education post, announced his death in a statement but did not provide further details. Page was 92. Under Page's leadership, the Department of Education implemented No Child Left Behind policy that in 2002 became Bush's signature education law, and was modeled on Page's previous work as a school superintendent in Houston, Texas. The law established universal testing standards and sanctioned schools that failed to meet certain benchmarks. Rod was a leader and a friend, Bush said in his statement. Unsatisfied with the status quo, he challenged what we called the soft bigotry of low expectations. Rod worked hard to make sure that where a child was born didn't determine whether they could succeed in school and beyond. Roderick R. Page was born to two teachers in the small Mississippi town of Monticello of roughly 1,400 inhabitants. The oldest of five siblings, Page served a 2-year stint in the U.S. Navy before becoming a football coach at the high school and then the junior college levels. Within years, Page rose to head coach of Jackson State University, his alma mater, and a historically black college in the Mississippi capital city. There, his team became the first, with a 1967 football game, to integrate Mississippi Veterans Memorial Stadium, once an all-white venue. After moving to Texas in the mid-1970s to become head coach of Texas Southern University, Page pivoted from the playing field to the classroom and education, first as a teacher, and then as an administrator, and eventually the dean of its College of Education from 1984 to 1994. Amid growing public recognition of his pursuit of educational excellence, Page rose to become superintendent of the Houston Independent School District, then one of the largest school districts in the country. He quickly drew the attention of Texas's most powerful politicians for his sweeping educational reforms in the diverse Texas city. Most notably, he moved to implement stricter metrics for student outcomes, something that became a central point for Bush's 2000s bid for president. Bush, who later would dub himself the education president, frequently praised Page on the campaign trail for the Houston reforms he called the Texas Miracle. And once Bush won election, he tapped Page to be the nation's top education official. As education secretary from 2000 to 2005, Page emphasized his belief that high expectations were essential for childhood development. The easiest thing to do is assign them a nice little menial task and pat them on the head, he told the Washington Post at the time. And that is precisely what we don't need. We need to assign high expectations to those people too. In fact, that may be our greatest gift, expecting them to achieve and then supporting them in their efforts to achieve. While some educators applaud the law for standardizing expectations regardless of student race or income, others complained for years about what they consider a maze of redundant and unnecessary tests and too much teaching to the tests by educators. In 2015, House and Senate lawmakers agreed to pull back many provisions from No Child Left Behind, shrinking the Education Department's role in setting testing standards and preventing the federal agency from sanctioning schools that failed to improve. That year, then-President Barack Obama signed the sweeping education law overhaul, ushering in a new approach to accountability, teacher evaluations, and the way the most poorly performing schools are pushed to improve. After serving as Education Secretary, Page returned to Jackson State University a half century after he was a student there, serving as the interim president in 2016 at the age of 83. Into his 90s, Page still publicly expressed deep concern and optimism about the future of U.S. education. In an opinion piece appearing in the Houston Chronicle in 2024, Page lifted up the city that helped propel him to national prominence, urging readers to look to Houston not just for inspiration, but for hard-won lessons about what works, what doesn't, and what it takes to shake up a stagnant system. That was the obituary titled, Rod Page, Nation's First African American to Serve as Secretary of Education, Dies at 92. This was written by Sophia Riddle and published December 9, 2025, at the AP.com website. Next, Moses Roper, the story of an American fugitive from slavery in Britain. This was written by Bruce Baker and published in the BBC History Magazine's HistoryExtra.com website on July 28, 2022. In December 1835, Moses Roper walked around Manchester with only 3 shillings in his pocket, enough to pay for a bed, though not for food. He was determined not to beg in the city of strangers. He had arrived in Liverpool on the last leg of a long and dangerous journey from slavery in the United States to freedom in Britain. But he knew no one there, and his family were still enslaved in North Carolina, thousands of miles across the sea. Moses Roper was a pioneer, the first African-American fugitive from slavery to make a home in Britain. In the 1830s and 1840s, he then established the Maritime Route to Freedom in Britain, launched a campaign that transformed the focus of British abolitionism, and formed a new family in freedom. Many others would follow the same route as him before the abolition of slavery in America in 1865. Formerly enslaved people had campaigned for abolition across the British Empire before, but Roper was the first of a new kind of activist. Born in North Carolina around 1816 or 1818, he was owned by a number of masters across North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and eventually Florida. In 1834, when he was about 17, he emancipated himself by running away to the free states of New England in the North. Yet, as long as he remained in the country, he was vulnerable to being captured and returned to slavery. To be sure of his safety, he needed to travel further afield. The same year as Roper's escape, Britain abolished slavery across its empire by an act of parliament. Many fugitive slaves traveled north along the Underground Railroad network and carried on until they reached Canada. But Roper chose to cross the Atlantic, carrying letters in his pockets from American abolitionists that introduced him to their British anti-slavery friends. They suggested that what he knew from first-hand experience might be the key to a new campaign against slavery. If a narrative of his life and adventures could be drawn up by some able pen, one American minister wrote to his British counterpart, it would be very popular and provide a true witness to what American slavery is. Roper traveled the length and breadth of Britain and Ireland, speaking in thousands of churches, village halls, and schoolrooms, anywhere he could find an audience. He told the story of slavery in the United States as he had experienced it, the inconsolable losses, unimaginable tortures he suffered, and his unstoppable will to be free. He paved the way for the many women and men who followed, such as Frederick Douglass, Henry Box Brown, William Wells Brown, Sarah Parker Remond, and William and Ellen Craft. African-American campaigners helped turn British public opinion resolutely against slavery. Tens of thousands of people heard Roper's story and the stories of those like him. Unlike in the West Indies, the British Parliament had no legal power in the United States, but could exert both moral and economic pressure. Crucially, when the American Civil War broke out in 1861 over the question of whether the nation would be, as President Abraham Lincoln had put it, all slave or all free, there was little doubt where Britain would stand. By turning British attention to American slavery, Roper's work transformed the landscape of abolitionism 7 years before Frederick Douglass crossed the Atlantic on his anti-slavery speaking tour. Yet, in the public debate on questions of race and justice, Roper's name has been all but forgotten, with the result that a crucial chapter in the history of black writing and transatlantic family remains hidden from view. In London in 1837, Roper published his autobiography, Narrative of the Adventures and Escape of Moses Roper from American Slavery. In it, he disclosed details of his birth family. His father was the slaveholder who owned his mother, and young Roper's embarrassing resemblance to his father meant he was sold away while still a child. He would then be passed from master to master across the South. He saw his family only once afterwards, when he escaped from a cruel owner in South Carolina and walked hundreds of miles home, only to be captured and returned to his master for more tortures. In Britain, though, he found people who could be the father figure he never had. Dissenting ministers Dr. John Morrison and Dr. Francis A. Cox of London, and Henry Christopherson, one of Morrison's congregants who took Roper into his London home, had, as Roper wrote, been towards me a parent. Yet this newly made anti-slavery family was also taken from him. In November 1840, after 3 years of successful lecturing and the sales of thousands of copies of his autobiography, Roper faced catastrophe. Reverend Dr. Thomas Price, a prominent Baptist minister and publisher, had written the preface for Roper's book in order to help him earn money to obtain a sound English education. Price believed that what Roper really should be doing was working as a missionary in Africa or the West Indies, not campaigning in Britain to persuade people to oppose slavery. Denouncing his lecturing as little more than a system of genteel begging, Price wrecked Roper's livelihood, cutting him off from the institutions and many of the people who had supported him. By that time, Roper had created a new life, one that illustrates the challenges of transatlantic migration and the complex histories of family descent in Britain. He had married a British woman, Anne Price, in Bristol the previous December. For a few months before Price's denunciation, his life was going smoothly as a gentleman in Chelsea with his wife and their new baby, Maria. By spring 1841, however, he was losing money, with fewer book sales and more expenses. The family moved to Wales, where Roper's autobiography was translated into Welsh. But their financial problems continued. In spring 1844, Roper sought assistance to immigrate to South Africa. When it was not forthcoming, the family immigrated to Canada West instead. He continued to lecture and campaign against slavery in Canada, and back in Britain and Ireland through the rest of the 1840s, despite the tragedy of his eldest daughter's death in 1847 and into the early 1860s. We do not know exactly when Roper stopped living with his family. He may have been with his wife and daughters when they left Canada in 1859, moving to Merthyr Tydfil to live with Anne's father. Was Roper there in 1863 when another daughter, also named Maria and born 2 years after her namesake, had succumbed to tuberculosis? Historians may never know. Following a few lectures near Cambridge, Roper slips quietly from the documentary record in spring 1861, just as the American Civil War began, after a quarter of a century of anti-slavery campaigning. It would be two decades later that he briefly reappeared, now an old man and speaking in churches and village halls in New England. He died alone in Boston in 1891, years after his wife and daughters, still in Britain, had assumed he was dead. That was the article titled, Moses Roper, The Story of an American Fugitive from Slavery in Britain. It was written by Bruce Baker and published July 28, 2022, in the BBC History Magazine's HistoryExtra.com website. My final reading for today's African American Hour is from Georgia and is about reparations. It's from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and its AJC.com website. The title is, Fulton's Past Racial Harm May Add Up to Billions. A Citizen Reparations Task Force researched the cost of slavery and discrimination over the years. This was written by Aaliyah Farr and published January 11, 2026. Elon Butts Osby's parents and grandparents were not the kind of people who liked to pack up and move. The decision was made for them because they were black. Osby's grandfather, William Backley, was forced to leave his 60-acre property in Forsyth County, Georgia, without compensation during the 1912 racial cleansing there. He resettled in Buckhead, in a neighborhood that became known as Backley Park, after he and his wife bought 10 lots. Then in the 1940s, the family was forced out again, so Fulton County could build a park for wealthy white residents of the neighboring Garden Hills subdivision. You start to wonder, and I try to stay away from this as much as I can, but why are we hated so much, said Osby, 75, who lives in the Northwest Atlanta home where his parents relocated from Buckhead. It may have been more obvious back in those times, but it's still just prevalent. Osby is a member of the Fulton County Reparations Task Force, a volunteer group that recently submitted a 636-page report on the harms Georgia's most populous county perpetrated through slavery and discrimination against black residents. The report did not tally one comprehensive amount quantifying the cost, though it said restitution for some practices could be worth billions of dollars today. Nor does it make any recommendations for payments or other actions to repair the damage. Those recommendations were the subject of the task force's next phase. People like to talk about how these harms were done in the past, and they're no longer our responsibility, and we fundamentally disagree with that, Amanda Ming, a task force member who is a researcher in the computer science school at Georgia Tech, told county commissioners last month. A lot of our data in the study show that these inequities are still visible today, and we're still responsible for them. The next part of the article is titled, Prosperity Built on Bondage. In the first decade after Fulton County was established in 1853, the county brought in about $75,000 from taxes on enslavers based on the assessed value of the people they enslaved, according to the report. Depending on the compound interest rate used today, that would equal anywhere from $2.4 million to $674 million today. Tax revenue from monetizing enslaved people paid for roads, the courthouse, jails, and salaries for commissioners, judges, and the sheriff, according to the Reparations Task Force's chairperson, historian and Morehouse College professor, Karshik Sims Alvarado. For Fulton County, the stakes were exceptionally high, the report says. It required reliable revenue to build its governing capacity. Taxation on enslaved people supplied 20-30% of its income, providing steady revenue that financed its growth into the state's commercial hub. In this sense, Fulton's prosperity was built on bondage, its public institutions literally financed by the appraised value of enslaved lives. After slavery was abolished, Fulton established Georgia's first county chain gang in 1876, which the report described as a brutal reincarnation of slavery, along with the statewide convict lease system. For the first 40 years, 86% of convicts whose races were recorded were black, the report said. Black people were arrested at high rates for minor crimes, it said. In 1870, investigation of the convict lease system found prisoners' sleeping quarters were often overcrowded and too few hours were allowed for sleep in the summer, the report said. Water was inadequate in many camps and inhumane punishments were inflicted at times, the report said. By 1874, privately contracted convicts were working on public projects in Fulton, the report said. Leased convicts were not paid. The Chattahoochee Brick Company used convicts to produce bricks for projects including the state capitol, the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, many Grant Park homes, the exterior walls of the Oakland Cemetery and the Pullman plant in Kirkwood. At Chattahoochee Brick, convicts were compelled to work on Sunday and at night, and that they were forced to carry loads of bricks at a fast trot from the ovens to be loaded into railroad cars. A 1907 investigation found convict food was bad and their sleeping and dining quarters were unsanitary, the investigation found. That report caused a public outcry and led to the end of the convict lease system statewide 2 years later. The county-run chain gang, however, continued until 1943. It consisted of people convicted of misdemeanors from Fulton and other counties, along with state felony convicts, the report said. Members of the chain gang built and paved roads, built bridges, dug culverts and roadside ditches and drained swamps, the report said. Convicts also worked in quarries, blasting, digging, and cutting stone and crushing gravel for county projects. Other convicts were put to work on municipal projects in Atlanta, building and improving roads, laying curbs and sidewalks, and building sewers. In 1889, a county grand jury reported the South Atlanta chain gang camp was unclean, food was inadequate, and convicts were whipped excessively, especially those who were sick or unable to do as much work as others. Many members of the Ku Klux Klan worked in Fulton's justice system during the first half of the 20th century, according to the task force report. Paul S. Etheridge, the Klan's national chief of staff in the 1920s, also chaired the county's Committee on Public Works, a position that gave him direct control of the chain gangs, the report said. The total loss for black convict laborers in Fulton County, if they had been paid and their wages had been invested over time, is between $4.6 billion and $13.6 million, the report said. The next part of the article is titled, Unequal Opportunities. Owning 60 acres of land was a notable accomplishment for a black man in 1912. After William Bagley and his wife Ida fled their Forsyth County farm, they became community leaders in their black enclave in Buckhead. William Bagley died in 1939. 9 years later, Fulton County offered the Bagley's daughter, Willie Mae, and her husband Pete Butts, pennies on the dollar to vacate their Buckhead home, said Osby, who is the Butts' daughter. Osby's parents accepted the offer. The alternative was being forced to move without payment, a fate that befell some neighbors, Osby said. 2 years later, Osby was born. As an adult, she did administrative work. She retired in June from Atlanta Housing, where she had worked as a senior administrative assistant and project manager. She has two daughters and two grandsons. Osby said she was not sure how much money Fulton County gave her parents. Today, their two lots were worth almost $4 million, and they might have been entitled to more from other inherited lots, Osby said. Property has always been a big thing in my family, she said. I think that during that era, it was a big thing with all black families. If you owned property, you were somebody. For her, the harm is largely emotional. The knowledge that her family's hard-won land could be and was taken away on the whims of their white neighbors. Fulton County assesses all the Bagley Park land the county seized in the 1940s at a total of nearly $60 million for tax purposes, according to the Reparations Task Force report, giving it a fair market value of about $150 million today. Speaking for herself, Osby said the county should compensate Bagley Park property owners' descendants based on current land values. If Osby's parents hadn't been forced out, she could have owned their land today, she said. The Reparations Task Force report also quantified the loss to black residents of books, job assistance, and educational programming caused by unequal access to the public library system until 1959, when the libraries were integrated. By 1959, Fulton County and the city of Atlanta owned and operated 2 colored libraries and 15 whites-only libraries, the report said. The whites-only branches included the Central Library, funded with a donation from industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. The small colored library served almost 97,000 patrons per site, while the white library served about 1/4 that number, leading to better resources and experiences for white users, the report said. We often didn't have the type of materials, or we didn't have enough materials to furnish a black citizen on whatever the citizen might be looking for. Librarian Annie McPheeter said, in a 1992 interview for Georgia State University Oral History that is quoted in the Fulton Reparations Task Force report, "And the citizens knew that this material was in the library, the main library, or maybe in some of the other larger branches." The state in 1983 transferred full responsibility over the libraries to the county. The estimated value of library services lost to black patrons under segregation, with compound interest through 2024, ranges from about $81 million to $1.7 billion, according to the Reparations Task Force report. These figures include losses in literacy support, youth programming, job readiness resources, and general civic participation opportunities, the report says. The next part of the article is titled, "Political Headwinds." The push for reparations over slavery and racism gained national prominence in 2020 after a white Minneapolis police officer murdered unarmed black man, George Floyd, by kneeling on his neck. The Fulton County Commission narrowly approved the creation of the Reparations Task Force in April 2021, with just 4 of 7 commissioners voting in favor. Fulton became the first county government in the United States to create such a task force. Fulton County Commissioner Marvin Arrington Jr. said he got the idea from Evanston, Illinois, which has begun making $25,000 reparation payments from cannabis tax revenue to some black residents, Bloomberg reported. The state of California in 2021 gave beachland back to descendants of black owners who had been forced out about a century earlier. The family later sold the land for $20 million. California's Reparations Task Force came up with more than 100 recommendations in 2023, including payments of up to $1.2 million to some residents, the New York Times reported. The state's governor, Gavin Newsom, signed legislation in October creating a structure for reparations, but vetoed related measures, citing cost among the factors. The city of San Francisco created a reparations fund in December, but did not immediately allocate money to it, the Bay City News reported. The concept of reparations also faces persistent opposition, particularly from white Americans, according to a series of Brookings Institution polls. Opponents cited the difficulty of determining how much is owed, the fact that no one directly involved in slavery is alive today, and the argument that slavery does not have current impacts. Fulton's task force was scheduled to dissolve at the end of this year, but the county commission last month granted a 2-year extension again with just 4 votes. Research has to be done to determine what's feasible based on economics, and that's not part of our current responsibility, task force member Rodney Little said before the vote. Republican County Commissioner Bridget Thorne asked if the Reparations Task Force analyzed benefits that were provided to the black community to try to help repair the harms. "Oh no," Sims Alvarado replied. "That data does not exist because the act has not occurred, which is what we're asking for now." In the heated exchange that followed, Thorne said her North Fulton constituents asked, "Why should we be responsible for a crime we didn't commit?" Thorn pointed to county spending on public transit, Grady Health, the Policing Alternatives and Diversion Initiative, and historically black colleges and universities. She also mentioned Title I grants, which the federal government provides school systems. Other commissioners argued those things are beside the point. Point of order, Mr. Chair, this has nothing to do with the topic, Arrington said. She's talking about MARTA. Chairman Rob Pitts repeated that the Reparations Task Force was presenting its findings, not its recommendations. He banged his gavel repeatedly while Thorne shouted over the argument. There isn't all harm, Thorne said before her microphone was cut off. I think your assumption is just incorrect in that what has been done in the past few decades is repair, Ming told Thorne. It's not repair unless the people who have experienced the harm, who are descendants of the people who have experienced the harm, have laid it out. Little said he is a third-generation descendant of the Tulsa Race Massacre. He supports reparations in Fulton County, although he does not expect to benefit from them. This is not a partisan issue, he said. This is a human rights issue. That was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution article titled, Fulton's Past Racial Harm May Add Up to Billions. A Citizen Reparations Task Force researched the cost of slavery and discrimination over the years. This was written by Aaliyah Farr and published January 11th, 2026. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.